You're listening to a program created at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you for supporting our research in consciousness and its practical applications for education, healthcare, and a more sustainable world. For more information, visit us at www.noetic.org.
Welcome to the Essentials of Noetic Sciences series. I'm Lindsay King, and tonight our host is ION's Director of Research, Cassandra Beaton, and she will introduce her guest, Roger Walsh. Welcome, Cassie.
Well, I'm very happy to be here to introduce someone who has been a virtual mentor and a pioneer in the science of meditation, Roger Walsh. He is a professor at the University of California, Irvine, and he's been the author of several books and really has been someone who has blazed a trail in understanding how mindfulness, meditation, and other transformative practices can help us achieve our human potential. Welcome, Roger.
Well, thank you very much, Cassie.
And so I would really love to hear from you, first of all, because I know that a lot of the people who are listening to our teleconference are sort of advanced in this topic, not just what is the sort of understood meaning of the science of meditation, but what is the most new and cutting-edge understandings that you've come to, maybe even in the last few years, about how meditation, mindfulness, and other related transformative practices can help us achieve our potential?
Well, let's see. I think probably we don't want to limit ourselves just to the scientific research here, because I think obviously, as you and probably a lot of the people who are part of our discussion are aware, this is one area of life and of exploration where our capacity for understanding is really a function of the depth of practice. So I think for me what's most intriguing is the growing convergence between quite ancient wisdom about the nature of the mind, our human potentials, the capacity for cultivating positive qualities and virtues, the extraordinary opportunities that are available to us to develop ourselves and our minds in ways that we really, in our culture, hadn't really not appreciated until very recently. What's most intriguing to me is the way that this ancient wisdom is in many ways finding at least tentative initial support from some of the scientific findings, and the way that the research is beginning to validate capacities which, frankly, most researchers didn't even believe in until quite recently. So that's one edge, and we'll doubtless explore others as we go along.
Well, I was just writing a paper today in which I referenced you, and the place that I referenced both you and Shauna Shapiro, who was meant to be here tonight but had to attend to the mindfulness of caring for her young son, have said that in some ways the way that we have constructed what is normal, healthy human development is almost an arrested development. It's almost like we've set a very low bar for what we have the potential to be as human beings. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
Very happily, because I really think that's one of the most intriguing, exciting, and important findings to emerge both from the practice of meditation and the research on it, and also from the emerging frontiers of developmental psychology. To my mind, one of the most exciting discoveries of developmental psychology, in fact, of all psychology in the last couple of decades, has been the realization that development can proceed far beyond what we thought of as our ceiling of possibilities, and that we used to think basically the mind pretty much stopped growing when the body stopped growing. You know, you don't get any taller after about age 20, and the idea was you didn't mature all that much psychologically after then too. But it's now becoming clearly apparent that we can progress beyond the conventional level, beyond what we once thought of the ceiling of our possibilities, into what are called post-conventional possibilities. developmental psychologists talk of maturation going from pre-conventional, that is, we come into the world unformed without an understanding of society or the conventions. We're gradually acculturated by both formal systems, such as our educational system, as well as informal systems, such as, you know, the media and parenting and an enormous number of other influences. We're brought up to the conventional level. But what we hadn't really realized is there's the possibility of moving beyond the conventional understanding of the way things are, beyond a kind of unquestioning assumption of the mores and values, beyond the ways of thinking and even the styles of thinking, so-called formal operational thinking, which was thought of as the kind of creme de la creme of cognitive intellectual development, into these post-conventional possibilities where we no longer are embedded in the conventional ways, the usual social ways of looking at things, but rather kind of are now able to step back, or in meditative terms, to mindfully view the what we'd formerly taken to be reality and the limits of ourselves. And the implication is that we can develop far more than we thought, and I think you summarized that well with your opening statement, that it's becoming increasingly clear that what we took to be normality is actually probably a form of collective developmental arrest. And that is both a frightening recognition, but also a terribly exciting one. It really points to enormous possibilities.
And so, go ahead. I'm just wondering if you could maybe talk about some of the capacities that might be possible for us that we haven't imagined yet.
Well, it's interesting. Researchers have now identified 12 psychological capacities that advanced meditators display that they'd formerly thought weren't really possible. We could talk first off about some very concrete things, like, for example, lucid dreaming, which I know has been an interest, you know, of some of the noetic community, the capacity to be aware that we're dreaming and to actually control and work with and even do spiritual practices in the dream state. Now, that's been known for actually millennia in the spiritual traditions and used quite widely, but only 30 years ago, Western psychologists and researchers in general just denied that that was possible. But then along came the meditative practices and popularizers like Stephen LaBerge, who's been associated with IONS. And it began to become very clear that it is possible to develop the skill of lucid dreaming, to actually cultivate this capacity, and that meditation is a wonderful way of doing that. And in fact, really advanced meditators are not only able to remain aware during their dreams, they're actually able to even be aware as they fall asleep in the non-dream state, and so that they can maintain a kind of continuity of awareness during sleep. Do I have time to tell a Dalai Lama story here?
Of course, yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, because there's a wonderful story about him that really brought this home to me. I was at a conference some years ago with the Dalai Lama, in which he gave a large group of psychologists, the International Transpersonal Association, and he said he'd like to give us a talk on dream yoga. And he said, well, what we do in our dream yoga practices is we teach our monks and nuns to be aware that they're dreaming. And I thought, oh, yeah, lucid dreaming, I know that, no big deal. And then he said, and then once they can do that, then we teach them to be aware between their dreams. So now they can watch themselves fall asleep, watch a dream begin, watch themselves between the dream, and remain aware throughout the entire night until they wake up. And at this stage, I realized I was out of my league. This was a whole different order of possibilities. And then he said, well, and then once they can do that, then we train them to be aware that the waking state is also a kind of dream. It's also a mental construction. So now they're continuously aware 24 hours a day. And they're aware also that what they're witnessing is actually a kind of a dreamlike phenomenon. It's a mental construction. And then he said, and once you can do that, then it's not too hard to remain aware as you watch yourself die and be reborn. I thought, okay, this is totally beyond my comprehension. But since he's supposedly done that 14 times, he certainly spoke with a little bit of authority there.
Well, one of the things I've been really interested in recently, because we are writing a paper right now on some findings of a precognition study that we've done, is that I'm not sure you're aware that Daryl Bem is coming out with a very landmark study on precognition. And although he doesn't relate it to meditative practices, the paper that we're working on relates it to meditative practices. And I'm wondering about this sense of timeless awareness, you know, when people who are advanced meditators have, and actually people who are in everyday life have these experiences as well, where they feel that their sense of perception through time expands, you know, it expands beyond the present moment. Do you have any experience with that?
Well, I think we're talking, yeah, and I think there are a couple of nuances we want to introduce there, Cassie. One is there are two major kinds of unusual experiences we want to talk about there, both of which can be cultivated by meditation. The first is a shift in the sense of time, that is how long things take. For example, meditators report that as they cultivate their awareness, they develop a micro-sensitivity and can watch things that are occurring with great rapidity. And the research bears that out. Meditators are actually, it's very clear that meditators have enhanced perceptual speed processing. They have an enhanced or refined perceptual sensitivity and a refined temporal sensitivity. That is, they can catch stimuli, very quick stimuli, faster than the rest of us could. And it's very interesting, as a little aside, that that advanced meditators have now been found better at detecting what are called micro-emotions or micro-expressions. Those are little facial expressions we make that in a fraction of a second convey or express the emotions we're feeling. And advanced meditators have been found now to be better at picking those up than the group who are formerly the best that had ever been discovered, who were CIA agents. So if you want to be a CIA agent, maybe meditation training would be good. But so one kind of temporal perceptual change is the capacity to have a sense of, for example, expanded time. But then there's a radically different kind of temporal awareness, which I think you're pointing to, Cassie, and that is the possibility, which multiple spiritual traditions point to, of a direct experience of that which is prior to time, a direct experience of pure awareness, pure consciousness, which has not entered the stream of time, which is, in technical language, ontologically prior to, or we could just say prior to, the whole phenomenon of time. And that is a very radically different experience, and that is the experience of essentially eternity. Now, in the popular culture, people think of eternity as something which lasts a long time, but that's actually a misunderstanding. A more sophisticated spiritual understanding is it's actually non-temporal or prior to time. So that's a very radically and different and very important experience that advanced practitioners have access to. And as you pointed out, all of us have, you know, occasionally this can just happen to people spontaneously.
And so if we bring the discussion more into sort of the mundane or the way that people experience their everyday world, what for you has been the most profound finding of meditation research or the research that you've done that affects people's happiness and well-being and health, just in the context of their own lives, even if they're not experiencing any kind of extended capacities which allow them to, perceive the future or maintain awareness during dreaming? It seems like there's also been quite a lot of research now on ways that people can use meditation and mindfulness in their everyday lives.
Yes, they have, and you have written on that with, of course, mindful parenting, which is one of the advanced meditation practices, to be sure. Maybe some of the intriguing findings relate simply to happiness, that there's increasing evidence that people who take up meditation practices, and I'm sure we'll find this is true for other spiritual practices too, tend to be happier. And that's not really so surprising, given that it's very clear that these practices are designed to foster emotional maturity, and they do that in two different ways. One is they reduce painful, destructive emotions such as fear and jealousy, anger and hatred, and they cultivate positive qualities such as love and compassion and joy, along with capacities like empathy. So it's really not surprising that they would enhance happiness, and there's growing evidence that from the research world, that yes, they do this. They do seem to reduce, for example, anger. They do seem to reduce fear, and certainly anxiety. In fact, one of the most probable thing meditation is used most for in clinical settings is to reduce anxiety and fear, and various anxiety neuroses and difficulties that arise therefrom. So that maybe those are some of the findings that are directly relevant to us all in our daily lives. Just you feel better when you do these practices.
So, Roger, tell me, how is it that paying attention to your breathing and your body sensations, it seems like such a simple thing to kind of maintain attention on your breathing and on your body sensations and on the waves of thoughts and feelings that come through. Why is it that that would lead us to more happiness or more balance?
Well, the meditative traditions have a very profound and important answer to that. They would say that two things. One is that our minds are out of control, very much out of control, way more out of control than we usually recognize, and until we start to actually try to train them. And the second thing they'd say is it is possible to train the mind. So actually that can be expanded a little, that they say that first, the mind is out of control. Second, that's where a lot of our suffering comes from. The fact that, for example, we can't control our thinking or our attention. You know, basically our minds are uncultivated, undisciplined, undeveloped. And they say that's what causes a lot of our suffering. But because everyone is in the same boat, we don't recognize it. The problem, we think that's the way the mind and we are. So we've kind of just accepted that's the human condition, that's the way the mind works. But the great discovery of the meditative, contemplative, yogic traditions is that the mind can be cultivated. One can train attention. One can develop greater perceptual sensitivity. One can foster emotional maturity. One can develop, cultivate wisdom, etc., and insight and understanding. And so from their perspective, what seems like a very simple practice, holding attention on the breath, is actually developing the mind. It's training attention. It's reducing the mind's wanderlust. It's not giving in to destructive, distracting emotions, etc. So although the actual practice seems very simple, the implication for them is actually it's doing a lot. And, you know, it becomes clear, you know. And, of course, one thing we need to acknowledge, and, of course, you and everyone listening is aware of this, that because a practice is simple doesn't mean it's easy. It sounds so simple to keep attention on the breath until you try it.
It's so interesting that, you know, in some ways we have really emphasized in our society the training of the mind in terms of the intellectual and the capacities of memory and logic and reason. We've de-emphasized the capacity of the mind to be metacognitive or to reflect upon its own functioning. And we've also elevated the intellectual mind to sort of a place of, dominance, whereas we've looked at the elements of how to be and how to respond to the world around us as less interesting or less important. And I'm wondering what you think about the implications of the findings that have been coming up recently and, of course, through millennia in the spiritual traditions in education.
Well, first off, just to acknowledge the importance of what you just said, that we have a hyper-intellectual culture, and we have all benefited from the intellectual development that has been the product of centuries of our cultural discovery and innovation. So not to underestimate the value of that, but you made the very important point that essentially we're out of balance. We've taken one aspect of the mind and developed it to extraordinary degrees, while leaving the others undeveloped and immature. And we are essentially in a race between consciousness and catastrophe, because our intellectual creations, ranging from weapons to all sorts of other things, have become so powerful. Our technology is now so powerful, unless we develop the rest of our psyches, we are very survival is at risk. So I think I really just want to first off just emphasize the importance of what you're saying about this imbalance. Then secondly, to acknowledge it and acknowledge what you said in another way, that our educational system is essentially a citadel or a cathedral to the intellect, and not so much to developing the other aspects of our being. And universities, that's where they focus, and that's not all bad, but it is tragic that the idea of education, which used to be a great liberal education, opening us to the wisdom of our culture and history and society, is increasingly being replaced by a technical emphasis and a preparation for the economy and the technical workforce. So I think not only are you saying something important, but something that's increasingly important, increasingly problematic. So then the question is, how do we balance that, and how do we bring appreciation of the other aspects of human nature and human mentality and emotionality and intuition, etc., into the educational system? And I think that's really, you're asking one of the key questions of our time, which may well determine our fate. Now, I think there are some interesting things being done. Center for Contemplative Mind and Society has done wonderful work in fostering the introduction of meditation into educational institutions. IONS, Institute of Noetic Sciences, is doing its part. You're doing your part with conscious parenting. I think we're going to need to bring this in at every level, from parenting through to universities. And I think the challenge for all of us is to look for ways that each of us can make a contribution. It's very interesting. Whenever you look at some big social problem, you ask, what can we do? It always ends up coming back to, well, what can I do? Because, of course, that's the only place each of us can begin and work with. So that's the kind of koan that we come back to each time, two koans. One is, what can I do? And second, what's the most strategic thing I can do?
So, Roger, I'm kind of appealing to you as an elder. You're someone who has managed to maintain mainstream credibility and someone who's sort of been a leader of this field. What would you tell to people who are maybe younger or people who are less experienced in their endeavor to bring these aspects more into mainstream society? I guess my question is, has something to do with what would you say to young scholars or to people who are really, really interested in being able to bring their knowledge and their experiments and their personal experience into this realm. I know that you have probably faced some resistance to your ideas, and we're very interested in, at IONS, in encouraging people who are trying to have a more holistic view.
Yes, and I'm delighted and I'm very grateful you're doing that. And once again, you're raising a really important question, which is actually a follow-on to what I was saying. You're raising the question, how do we optimize our contribution? And I think that's really a wonderful question for each of us to keep asking ourselves. There are a few thoughts that come to mind. The first thing is, let's just clarify this question. So really what you're asking is, for those IONS members and people interested in this, in the kind of noetic work, how do we optimize our contribution in bringing these perspectives and practices into the mainstream? And so I think the first thing to be aware of is that you're asking a particular kind of question. You're asking what's a wisdom question. And there, it's important to know there are two kinds of questions. There are knowledge questions and wisdom questions. Knowledge questions have a one-time answer. You know, is it raining outside? Take a look. No. End of question. But wisdom questions are kind of like koans. They're lifetime questions that each time you ask them, they take you deeper into yourself and have the potential for unveiling deeper answers. So you're asking a wisdom question. How do we optimize our contribution in bringing these ideas and perspectives and practices to the mainstream? And so it's important to know that this is a long-term question. It's going to be with us, you know, maybe for years, maybe even for a lifetime. Second thing I think that's important to know is that if you're going to influence the mainstream, it really helps to be good at whatever area of the culture and mainstream you want to impact. That is, if you want to talk about bring meditation into, say psychology, then it's really good to know psychology, maybe to have a degree in it, maybe, but certainly to be, you know the language of the people you're talking about to. If you want to talk to teachers, it's good to know what they're working with, their issues, etc., so you can really speak their language and speak to them and really connect with them. So one thing is, the first thing is, it's good to know the part of the mainstream culture you want to connect with. The second thing is a very interesting one, and it's a deep one. That is, if you're trying to communicate what is not just knowledge, but a deeper perspective and a kind of wisdom, then it's really important to imbibe that wisdom or that, and do that practice, for example, meditation or contemplation or whatever it is you're trying to introduce, to do it as deeply as you can, because you're really trying to communicate not only factual information, but your own experience. You want to be able to speak from your own depths and talk very openly and authentically about the value that these things have had for you personally. And so that means doing the practices, whether it's, you know, art or music or meditation or yoga or whatever it is, being immersed in that in your own way and cultivating that as deeply as possible. And the third thing that's required is to be able to speak from your own experience, but with the factual information, in such a way as to create an understanding for people, so they go, aha. So if you're talking to teachers, well, you know, I really, my own experience is that this is really valuable in being able to get, you know, help kids, you know, pay attention and hear, listen deeply, and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a number of things here, but those seem to be some of the main elements. I'd actually be interested, you know, you do this with your parenting work. You probably have some, I'm sure you have lots, I know you have lots of thoughts on this yourself.
Well, I think the most important things that I'm abstracting from what you're saying are to, number one, know the language, in which you're speaking, so to really be well-versed in the language and to not polarize yourself intentionally. I mean, this is one thing that I've been encountering recently myself, which is that, you know, polarizing yourself as an alternative to the mainstream has some benefit, but it also has some limitations.
Well,
and then
nice
also, yeah, and then to walk your talk, you know, to really be, because it seems that even though evidence is a very important element, or information is a very important element of how we all transform, it's only one of the elements, and really it's the stories and the personal experience and the modeling of what you have realized that's really important. And then to, you know, to be able to convey, now that you've learned the language and now that you've had your own experience, in a meaningful and discerning way, what you know is helpful. And
beautiful.
So I'd love to hear a little bit more about what our listeners are experiencing in this domain. And I know that the Q&A part of these sessions is always the most rich and fruitful. So I kind of want to open it now to the people who are listening and talking about how you are incorporating these wisdom messages into your system, and how you're also bridging the gap in discerning ways to the mainstream. That would be great.
Okay, so we'll now we will have our Q&A time. And if you would like to ask a question of our guest, Roger Walsh, or host, Cassandra Veeton, please press 1 on your phone keypad now. And sometimes our system doesn't work that great, so it would be good if you could press 1 two or three times just to make sure we get it. And while we're waiting for somebody to press 1, I will read one of the questions that was sent in to us. Catherine says, what do you know about the effects of neurofeedback and meditation? How about binaural beat brain entrainment technology? What is the most effective meditative approach in stabilizing effects of emotional trauma and traumatic memory on the human nervous system?
What's the most effective way of stabilizing? I assume that means healing. Let's see. Well, let me just preamble by saying there's a little bit of a challenge in responding to that kind of question, because a lot of these clinical questions, how does one heal particular traumas or difficulties, really there's a lot of variation from person to person. Ideally, you want to be able to sit with a person and talk with them. So I think one thing that's key is to find a good counselor, therapist, healer to talk with. That's the first step, and then to work with, develop an individual program drawing on the best of both contemplative, spiritual, psychological, and sometimes even pharmacological approaches, and tailoring them to the particular situation that the person is wrestling with.
Okay. If you would like to ask a question, again, please press 1 on your phone keypad. And haven't heard from anybody yet, so we will ask another email question. This one is from Catherine, and she says, having been a meditator for many years, I am now finding it difficult to turn off the mind to reach the still place. On a recent IONS call, it was suggested that when this is the case, it may be a time to find a different meditative practice. Will you give some examples of other types?
So let's see, did I understand she was doing a particular, did she say what type she was doing?
She didn't say what type she had been doing.
Let's see, well, certainly there can be advantages in trying different kinds of practices. Without knowing what practice she's been doing, it's difficult to suggest a particular one, but of course there are a wide array of practices, and of course we don't want to stick just to meditation per se. We also want to consider contemplative practices from other traditions, and we want to also consider yogic practices, physical-based practices. And also, let's keep in mind that meditation is not a practice to be done in isolation. It's traditionally, and for very good reasons, part of a rich multidimensional practice, which includes everything from lifestyle to diet to study to interaction with teachers and with a community. So I think a general principle is to draw on as many of these as possible. And in our contemporary world, of course, we have a whole range of psychotherapeutic practices also. And I think one of the things, to go back to one of the questions that Cassie began us with, was what are some of the most exciting research findings coming out. I think one of them is it's increasingly clear that the combination of meditation or spiritual practice and psychotherapy can be very beneficial. And that when people that spiritual practice, meditation can accelerate psychotherapy on the one hand. On the other hand, when people are stuck in meditation, when there are, for example, repetitive, painful memories coming up or old traumas or symptoms and difficulties or you know, any number of things where they're feeling stuck, sometimes they can be unstuck quite quickly with a few therapy sessions. So I think one thing to keep in mind is that we have an unprecedented array of practices and healing modalities available to us today which have never been available in human history. And that's an extraordinary gift. At the same time, it's also an opportunity and a little bit of a challenge to find out what is the optimal combination of approaches for us. Cassie, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I would just jump in there to say that one of the transformative experiences for myself when I was doing the transformation study that led to the publication of the book Living Deeply was that I encountered many people who said, you know, I really can't sit and observe my thoughts and my sensations and my emotions. You know, it's too distressing. It's too difficult. And one of the people that we interviewed was Lauren Archess, who does the labyrinth meditation. And she said, you know, I never really could sit with my thoughts and my feelings and my body sensations, and I had to walk. And walking the labyrinth for her was a transformative experience where she said, wow, once I started moving, and as I was moving, contemplating my thoughts and feelings and sensations, that made all the difference. And so I think one of the things that is unique about IONS is that we don't necessarily attach ourselves to one transformative practice, but we know that there are many transformative practices that can help people. And there are also mantra meditations that can help stabilize the mind for quite a while, where, you know, I've heard this phrase, the meditation mafia, which is sort of a dogmatic approach to meditation that says there's only one way. And I think what we're all coming to is that the possibility that there probably isn't one way. There are probably multiple paths to the same outcome.
Well said. Yeah. Yes, indeed. And I think that's one of the discoveries of our time, Cassie, is just that not only are there multiple ways to learn and to heal and to grow and to even to awaken, but that some skillful combination of ways is very important. And maybe just to add that one of the real traps that spiritual practitioners fall into, and it's a very, very painful one, is feeling that their spiritual practice alone should be enough to handle all their challenges and life difficulties. Mm-hmm. And that can be a really tragic belief. It's kind of like a spiritual superego, or as you called it, the meditation mafia. I love that phrase. And I actually did an article on this, which is available on the web, called Meditate or Medicate, because there are a number of people, spiritual practitioners, who, for example, suffer from depression and think they should be able to handle their depression with spiritual practice alone, and in point of fact, sometimes they just suffer for years when a brief a brief period of medication, pharmacotherapy, can alleviate the depression sufficiently so that they can do their spiritual practice much more effectively. And the bottom line is, you know, we have all these different approaches now, and as you were saying, Cassie, we should be availing ourselves of them and using them skillfully. And if for Catherine, if you want a kind of compilation of practices, I did a book, Essential Spirituality, which basically looked at an array of different practices and the complementary roles they can have. So, you know, you might look at that if you're interested. Essential Spirituality, the Seven Central Practices.
Okay, thank you. And I'll just say again, if you would like to ask a question, please press 1 on your keyboard now. Oh, here we go. I'll give the mic to Catherine. Catherine, go ahead.
Yes, I'm the Catherine that sent the question in. And just wanted to thank you for your response. You said something about it cannot be done in isolation. You need a community, a partner. How would you say a little bit more about that? Because in a sense, I've lost the community that I was a part of.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so I'm kind of I'm on my own right now and have had different thoughts maybe of starting a meditation group, but I'm a bit floundering myself, so don't feel that confident in doing that. So could you say something about the need for community?
Yeah. Let's see. You know, I mentioned this book, Essential Spirituality, and you know, it took me 3 years to write that thing, and I spent 3 years researching the world's spiritual traditions and looking at them and seeing what they had to say. You know, my central question is, so what are all the great world's great religions say, what do they agree on that is really important in the way of practices for us to do to become full human beings, to live fully and happily and to awaken to our true nature? And the thing which surprised me most in those 3 years, that every one of the great religions said, for every one of the 7 qualities that they said were qualities were really important to develop, they all said, if you want to develop these qualities, one really good way of doing it is to hang out with people who have them. In other words, find people who are fellow practitioners and ideally people who have been at it a little longer and have developed these qualities, because consciousness is catchy. You know, fortunately, good emotions, good motives, spiritual values, etc., are contagious in a positive way. So yes, there's widespread agreement across spiritual practices that it's really valuable to have a community of fellow practitioners and ideally teachers. So if you can possibly find them, and if you can't, then you do your practices by yourself as best you can. Of course, now we have the good fortune of having, you know, organizations like IONS and lots of other resources available on the web, et cetera, and lots of things you can download. So, you know, just because we're alone doesn't mean we can't do them. But if you can find a support group, by all means do it. And I certainly would want to encourage you to consider forming a meditation group, even if you don't feel like you are floundering, because, you know, we learn from each other. And it doesn't mean because you form the group you have to sit, you know, you don't have to set yourself up as a guru. You just be a fellow practitioner.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's very helpful to me right now.
Great, Catherine.
Well, and I love what Catherine said, because one of the things I'll share about being a researcher in transformative practices is that when I started interviewing people about what really transformed their lives, and I had the opportunity to interview 60 masters and teachers of different transformative traditions, I would say that the number one thing that emerged from my question about what facilitates a transformative way of life was community. And the next thing was daily reminders. And it was so interesting because before then I had kind of come to a place where I thought, you know, these little daily reminders seem so trivial. You know, the bobble-headed Buddha on the dashboard or the necklace or the bracelet or the bumper sticker. You know, I thought, oh, these are just trivializing transformative practice and spirituality. And what most of these teachers told me was they really need those things. They need the daily reminders. They need the community. They need the language in order to translate their transformative experience. So I totally agree with Roger that encouraging you to form a community that is perhaps leaderless, you know, that really doesn't have a leader but has a desire to evolve as a human being is a really useful thing.
Very nicely said, yes, yes. And just to ride on what you're saying, Cassie, isn't it amazing how often it turns out to be, let me just do a slightly different tangent and say, I think I've learned the same thing from these people. One of the things that's really struck me is that people who have really made a lot of progress emphasize, even people who've done years in retreat, the daily practice, the dailiness of it, having something they do on a daily basis.
Okay, thank you. Our next question comes from Sandy. Sandy, go ahead. You have the mic.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I was going to ask about, from a beginner perspective, I mean, this wasn't something that I ever saw myself trying or being interested in. It was something that was recommended for me to try, and I pretty much do it in secret. and on some level, I'm almost embarrassed about it, and I know I shouldn't be. But I'm a near-death experiencer, and I've been told that meditation can be helpful for someone who's had that kind of a life experience. So do you have any advice for somebody who's very much a beginner and just kind of floundering by herself doing what she can?
In the realm of meditation, you mean, or in
yes.
With the consequences of the near-death experience, or both? Or?
With trying to figure out how to meditate and what's the best way to go about it. And I mean, I find for me that it tends to bring out a lot of anomalous experiences,
mm-hmm.
which sometimes kind of make me stop doing it at all because I'm worried about them. But then if I don't do it, I get more stressed out about whatever anomalous experiences I have.
Yeah, right. Well, first off, just to acknowledge that something that you're probably aware of, that as a near-death experiencer, you are quite likely to be more sensitive than most of us and to be more open to those kind of experiences. And it might be very valuable for you to make contact with other experiences and to have some sort of community there. And that's going along the lines of what Cassie was talking about, the importance of community. Then as regards the meditation practice, I think some of the things we were talking about before would be key. First off, just to acknowledge that this is a long meditation and spiritual practice is a long-term process, so you start at it, and you just keep at it. And I think if you know that what's really important is, as Cassie was saying, to have some sort of daily practice. And also the point she was making that there are a lot of different practices, and maybe yours is as Cassie was saying, more on the movement line. Maybe it'll be a yogic practice, more body focused. So to follow up on what she was saying, to encourage you to investigate a variety of practices and see what really moves you and works well for you. So that's one thing. Then to acknowledge the importance of community and that if you can find a group of people to work with and be with, that would be very helpful. And also if you can find a teacher of some kind, someone who you feel good about that you can connect with, who's a spiritual teacher, a meditation teacher, a yoga teacher, whatever you're drawn to. All those elements, I think, could be very valuable. Does that connect for you?
It's helpful. I'm not exactly in a like I'm in a fairly isolated area, so I don't have access to a lot of other people. You know, online is kind of where I get a lot of my access to just the world in general from.
Okay. So, and have you found communities online?
A certain amount, but I, you know, there's only so many of us out there.
Yeah,
this is Cassie. I would just say that, you know, one of the things that has been so interesting to me is that if you can trust your internal experience and really tune into what is life-affirming and health-affirming and what makes you feel happy and good, these are the things that you can follow. And sometimes there are teachers or traditions that say, you know, hey, you know, it's good that you move towards more deconstruction or more difficulty. That's true in a way, but in reality, if you can find things that make you feel more happy, more full of integrity, more happy and, I don't know, more in alignment with who you are, then those are the things that are worth following. And so that if those are a teaching or a practice or a community, I would really trust your your internal intuition. And I think what Roger was saying earlier is that we haven't really been trained in the capacity to trust our intuition, to really connect with what inside feels like the right thing, what feels like it's moving me toward more wholeness, more integration, more happiness. And I think you can really trust those things that feel like they are moving you more toward those outcomes.
And I would I would want to reinforce that. That sounds sounds right to me, yeah. But this is increasingly the spiritual path becomes one of listening to the, well, you know, what has been called many things, a still small voice or the inner guidance or the sense of, what as Cassie was saying, what feels right and what feels good.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for all your questions. So we're getting close to the top of the hour, so now we'll turn the mic back over to Cassie.
Well, I guess I would say, Roger, that I'm so happy to talk to you for an hour, and we rarely get these hours to talk together, and it's just lovely to be able to spend time with you. And do you have any final recommendations or places that people can go? I know you've mentioned your book, Essential Spirituality, that is really a pioneering effort in the, I guess, the perennial philosophy, which what that means is what are the things that all the traditions agree upon, and there's some kind of trust that we can put in the recommendations that all the traditions agree upon, regardless of dogma or regardless of specific recommendations. I think essential spirituality is a good place to turn, but do you have any other good places to turn for people who are listening?
Well, I think there are so many resources available now on the web, and I think it largely depends on what people are drawn to. I guess I would the main thing I'd want to encourage people to do is to keep looking and to whatever you do, find some practice that works for you, that feels, as Cassie was saying, intuitively right and positive and helpful and healing and that benefit, and to stick with it, and to recall a human existence is not a small challenge, and that these practices take time, and so whatever you do, to keep exploring, to keep practicing, and to keep investigating. And over time, wonderful things unfold, and they're not only a benefit to us, they're fortunately can be a wonderful benefit to others too.
We hope you enjoyed this program from IONS. Located in Petaluma, California, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a nonprofit membership organization that conducts scientific research into the potentials and powers of consciousness. To learn more about IONS, please visit us at www.noetic.org or call toll-free 877-769-4667.